Welcome to the Wonder Women Tech Show, where we highlight, celebrate, and amplify global leaders who are creating impact. We humanize our role models and curate a culture of vulnerability and belonging. This is a show designed to innovate, empower, and ignite. I'm your host, Lisa Mae Brunson. Innovators, it's Lisa Mae Brunson with the Wonder Women Tech Show, and I'm so excited because today's guest, Dr. Ellen Ochoa, is the first Hispanic female astronaut, and she was the director of NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas from 2013 until her retirement in May 2018. She became the first Latina to go to space when she flew on a 9-day mission aboard the shuttle Discovery in 1993. She has flown in space 4 times, logging nearly 1,000 hours. She currently serves on several boards, including serving as chair of the National Science Board. Prior to her astronaut career, Dr. Ochoa was a research engineer and holds 3 patents for optical systems. She received a BS in physics from San Diego State University and both an MS and PhD in electrical engineering from Stanford University. She is honored to have six schools named for her and has been inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame, the California Hall of Fame, and the International Air and Space Hall of Fame. Dr. Ochoa, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa Mae. It's great to talk with you again.
I know. It is so wonderful to have you here and share space again. But I just had to open this conversation up to honor and celebrate all of the amazing achievements you've accomplished so far, because your bio reads like someone who has just knocked life right out the park and there's like nothing else left to achieve.
I know. Sometimes it's hard to actually reconcile that with the person that I know that I am.
You're like, who is that woman? I mean, welcome back to the Wonder Women Tech ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a great way to start the year.
It really is. I mean, I'd love you to take us on a trip down memory lane. Like, we didn't get to really talk about this the last time we hung out, but I'd love to learn more about your roots. You know, I know your grandmother is an immigrant, and, you know, I just want to get inside of your childhood and discover what it was like growing up in La Mesa, California.
Okay, sure. Well, my dad's parents, as you know, were from Mexico. But by the time my dad was born, he was the youngest of 12. They had moved to California. So he was born in Southern California, in Anaheim. My mom came from Oklahoma. And my dad worked at Sears. And so we moved to a suburb of San Diego, La Mesa, when I was about a year old, from the Los Angeles area. And, you know, I think I had a fairly typical suburban kind of childhood there. Probably one of the things I most liked to do was read. I also started playing the flute when I was 10. But I really didn't know much about science, didn't think I was interested in it. I didn't know any scientists or engineers. So even in high school, I only took biology. I should have taken chemistry and physics as well, but I just didn't. And so I came to science maybe much later than a lot of people who choose science.
You would have never guessed that with like all of your degrees in, in physics and science. That's really fascinating. I mean, at what point did you pick it up and say, wow, this is something that I could get into?
It was when I was in college, and I really came to it through my math classes. I did take a lot of math in high school, fortunately, and I continued on in college. And so it was really when I was finishing up the calculus series and talking to the other students. You know, I was really just in there because I always liked math, and most of the other people were in there because they were studying engineering or physics, and they needed to learn the math that went with it. So I decided I'd try to find out a little bit more about those subjects and see whether it might be something I was interested in. So I went and talked to 2 professors. One was a professor in the electrical engineering department. This was all at San Diego State University, which was our local university. And unfortunately, it was clear he was not interested in having me in his department. He said, oh, we had a woman come through the program once, but you know, it's a really difficult course of study, and I don't know that you'd be interested in it, which was ironic since I had set up this appointment specifically to ask him about it. But fortunately, I got a much different reception from the physics professor that I went and talked with. And he seemed glad that I was interested to learn more about physics. He told me about some careers that people have, different ways that they could go if you've studied physics, which was really important because I didn't really know that. I didn't have a good picture in my mind of what somebody did with a physics degree. And then he did ask about my math background, and I told him I was finishing up the calculus series. And he said, well, that's great, because if you started into physics next semester, you would have already learned the language of physics and you could concentrate on the concepts. And most of the students in the class will be trying to learn those simultaneously. So I think you do really well. That's exactly what I ended up doing. I started into physics the next semester and liked it. And that was how I got into it.
I mean, for those of us that have no idea what physics is, can you just share a quick little learner course about like what exactly is physics and how do we apply it?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's really the science that explains things that you see and experience every day in the physical world, whether it's light, heat, motion. You know, all of those things are really described by physics and explained, and there are equations that allow you to predict what's going to happen. You know, when there's an object in motion and it comes across other forces, or, you know, just light coming from the sun, electromagnetic energy, those are things that you study in physics as well. So even though you end up getting into the nitty-gritty with equations that explain how this works, to me, it's really about understanding just what you see as you go through your life every day in just everyday things. You know, why does a flag wave? Just all those kinds of things.
So you got your Bachelor of Science degree in physics at San Diego State University. You graduated Pi Beta Kappa, and you earned your Master of Science degree and doctorate from Stanford Department of Electrical Engineering. But at what point did you say, you know, this is all great, but now I want to be an astronaut?
Well, when I went off to graduate school, I went off to Stanford at the end of my first year there. About when I was getting my master's degree is when the space shuttle flew for the first time. So, you know, it was a very different kind of spacecraft than had ever flown before. And even though that was just the first flight, NASA was talking about what they planned to use it for in the future. And it had many different capabilities and uses, but certainly a big one was the ability to do research in space of all different kinds. And looking at doing experiments that you could not do on the surface of the Earth. So, you know, I was about to start into a PhD program in electrical engineering. It was really applied physics. So I was looking at a career in research engineering. And the idea of combining, you know, space and unique experiments with this interest in research is what really piqued my interest. And a couple years later is when Sally Ride flew, first American woman in space. So that was a huge deal. You know, obviously, before Sally and her class was selected, women weren't allowed to be astronauts. And so now the field was open to, you know, people who studied science and engineering, and it was much broader. And now they were recruiting from a wider variety of people.
Yeah, so that really just opened the door for you to be able to walk through it and make your mark. So when you first went to NASA, you were the first Hispanic female astronaut. But, you know, how many women were in your particular class? And when did you start to see a real shift in women interested in becoming astronauts?
In my class, there were 23 astronauts who were selected at the same time, and five of us were women. And I would say overall at that time, it was about 20% women in the astronaut corps, which may sound low, but I will say, you know, just from my experience in graduate school and my first job after graduate school at a Department of Energy lab, that was considerably higher than what I had seen before. And I had actually worked at NASA a couple of years as a research engineer and as a supervisor before being selected as an astronaut. And it was already clear when I went to NASA that they had made an effort to not only recruit women, but other underrepresented minorities. I mean, they were starting from very little, right? So, you know, had a long way to go, but they clearly had more women there and other people of other racial and ethnic minorities that you didn't see a whole lot in science and engineering than I was used to seeing. So I actually felt, you know, that I was going into an environment which was much more representative than what I was used to. And of course, since then, you know, that was over 30 years ago, NASA has really increased that. And so, you know, one thing that you didn't really see too much at NASA then was women in leadership roles. And, you know, over the ensuing decades, of course, now you have seen women in all kinds of visible and leadership roles at NASA. And I think to a much greater extent there than you see in some technical areas, in some companies, maybe in the tech industry.
Yeah.
So, and I think NASA really consciously understood that they had an opportunity to raise the visibility of people you didn't normally see in science and engineering or the astronaut corps, and realize that who they selected into the astronaut corps was going to make a difference in terms of them being able to send that message.
Now, I'm curious. So when you're accepted into the corps, is everyone guaranteed to finish, or, you know, do people drop out? Do people get taken out?
Well, there's definitely never any guarantees about flying in space, because you just don't know exactly, first of all, what the country is going to support in a human spaceflight program. And then there can always be other issues that crop up, you know, medical issues or something that would make you ineligible. But the idea when I was selected, and really since then, is we want everybody that we select to fly. That's our goal. We're going to put a lot of resources into training all of you, and we want to see you all fly. So they try to do all the weeding out before they actually select the groups that will come and train for the astronaut corps.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, you know, when you're going to the military, you have all of this training, you have to be physically fit, there's mental exercises, there's team coordination. What are some of, like, because I'll never be an astronaut, but what are some of the things that you had to go through to prepare yourself for something like this? Because I imagine even just the endurance that you would have to get to space and be in space is something most of us could never do, right?
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of training. And actually, that was one of the things I loved about being an astronaut was, you know, every day was different and I got to do a lot of different things. But you can kind of put them in two big buckets. And one of them was, you know, learning about the shuttle systems, learning about some of the science that we would be doing experiments on. You know, we were handed a large stack of workbooks to read about each one of the shuttle systems that we were expected to study and learn. And that was all really familiar to me, not because I knew the subject matter already, but because I'd spent 10 years in college and I knew how to study, you know, I knew how to learn things. And so it was easy to dive into that. And then there was a whole operational aspect that I really wasn't familiar with. So for one thing, astronauts fly in high performance jets. Somebody like me who didn't have much aviation experience, I had gotten a private pilot's license, but didn't have very many hours, and of course had never flown in a high performance jet, you know, where you need to wear an oxygen mask and wear a parachute, and you're going much faster than, you know, something like a Cessna. So we learned to fly backseat, but you can take the stick once you're 200 feet off the ground. So you actually do a lot of the flying and you do communications and navigation. And then part of that, as well as it's applicable to the shuttle, is, you know, how would you bail out of an aircraft? Or bail out of the shuttle at the very end of a mission, for example. And so landing under a parachute on land or in water, getting picked up by a Coast Guard helicopter. We did a little bit of land and water survival training, you know, making a tent out of our parachute material, as well as setting up signals to get the attention of a helicopter who might be coming to rescue you. We went through a scuba course because the training for spacewalks occur in a large pool at Johnson Space Center, and you need to be scuba qualified to be able to do that. So these were all things that were pretty new to me. You know, I had never even been a Girl Scout, but fortunately, like I said, the goal was we want everybody to learn these skills, and you need them to feel comfortable and be safe as an astronaut and be able to respond to all different kinds of scenarios, both, you know, just the normal procedures, but all different kinds of emergency scenarios. And so people were there to help you learn. And my fellow classmates helped me. A lot of them were in the military, and you know, this was all old hat to them. So, like I said, just something different, you know, all the time, which is one of the things I really enjoyed about it.
You know, as I'm listening to you talk, and it's no secret, I've always been fascinated with space. You and I discussed that. I wanted to be an astronaut. But as I'm listening to you, thinking about having to bail out of a jet and being rescued in water, I'm just like, no, there's no way. I would 100% have failed the second that they told me to get in any kind of a high-speed jet. Yeah, that's really fascinating, though, because I imagine you learn a lot about yourself in this process because you have to push yourself to all sorts of limits, not just being outside of your comfort zone, but physically, you are putting yourself in very real danger.
Certainly, there's risk involved. You know, everybody works hard at NASA to minimize the risk, but there's no question that there's risk involved. And you have to approach what you're doing and any scenario that you might find yourself in. What I would say is just sort of in a methodical way, trying to learn about it, trying to learn about what you can do when you find yourself in a situation where problems are happening and things aren't going the way that you want. But I think all of that really prepares you for space. You know, people ask me, well, were you scared on your first launch? And, you know, the reason that I wasn't scared, I mean, obviously I was keyed up, probably a little bit nervous about the whole flight, just wanting to do well. But I wasn't just scared sitting there in the shuttle. And it was because of the training. It was because, okay, I've sat in the seat 100 times, well over that, in training, in simulations. We've been through so many different failure scenarios. And there are some situations for which you can't do anything about, but there's a whole lot for which there are actions that you as a crew member that can take and that people in mission control can take. And we're trained to respond to those. So it really helps you approach the mission, I think, with the right mindset.
Yeah. And there is something to be said for mindset, because the whole time I'm listening to you, I'm thinking this is a special kind of person to take on these kinds of, you know, experiences, these kinds of careers. I've had the privilege to be able to talk to so many amazing people who are in unique professions that I could never, ever see myself in. I mean, I have a high active fight or flight response. It's hard for me to have like that mind over matter mindset, but right. Like I've talked to amazing people like you who demonstrate that. They talk about being cool under pressure and even thriving under pressure. And as you're sharing your experiences, I'm literally like my palms are sweating. I'm like feeling incredibly uncomfortable because I'm a visual person. So as you're telling me this, I actually am physically responding, but you're just like, oh yeah, I mean, this is how you do it. And I do think that there are people that are just built for this, and we need people like you who will go there.
Well, you know, I have to say that, you know, if you talked to me when I was much younger, I would have had a hard time visualizing myself doing it too. I wasn't a particularly adventurous person. You know, our family didn't camp. Like I said, I wasn't even a Girl Scout. So this was all really new to me. And of course, I had questions about, you know, how well am I going to do? Am I going to be able to do and learn what I need to do? But as I said, people were there to help you be successful. And it was something I wanted to do so badly. And so it was really a matter of learning about the systems, learning about the aircraft, learning about the shuttle, so that you do feel you understand, even when something's not going right, you know, what your options are in terms of responding to that. So, you know, even if somebody's listening to this and is thinking like, oh, I just don't know if I could do that, all I can say is I would have been in the exact same situation.
Yeah, don't listen to Lisa May. That's fear. Like, that's just my fear. Listen to Ellen. Yeah, I mean, you know, I have been, though, in instances and experiences where I've learned so much about myself doing things that I never would have guessed I could do. So there is absolutely something to be said for that, because I'm afraid of heights and I've climbed some very treacherous mountains in Italy, like literally scaling these things and looking over and you could just fall right off the cliff. So there's something to be said for the human spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, I am not at all fond of heights myself. And you would actually be surprised at the number of astronauts who really don't like heights. So I think it's just interesting that you can't always assume certain things about people in terms of what they've done and sort of how they've overcome certain things.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The industry is pretty male dominated. Were there any challenges that you faced with that dynamic? And did you have any mentors who supported you?
Well, let's see. When I joined the Astronaut Corps in 1990, this was 12 years after the first class of astronauts was selected specifically for the space shuttle program. And that was the first one that included women and the first one that included minority astronauts. So I think they had a different experience than I did, but I certainly benefited from that 12 years, right? Where now it wasn't an unusual or a new thing to see yeah. women in the astronaut corps. And of course, a number of those women in the first class had flown a couple of times. Sally Ride, Kathy Sullivan, who was the first American woman to do a spacewalk. And of course, they'd done really well. Which shouldn't be surprising. I don't think that being an astronaut is something that men should be expected to do better than women. You know, it's a matter of learning things. And that just made it easier for those that, like me, that came after them. And then I hopefully our class and others made it easier. And again, more common to see for people that have come since. And I think that's part of our jobs, right? You know, you're trying to do a good job yourself and be as good as you can in a particular career that you've chosen. But in doing that, you are also setting an example for people who are younger than you or who just come into a field after you, who see you and realize, well, you know, there's no reason I can't do this.
Yeah. I mean, as we're seeing with the new vice president of the United States, you know, having a woman in office and a woman of color in the highest office in the nation. It does really do something to a person who's like, oh, there's so many barriers, there's so many challenges. But then when you see that, I mean, you just awaken to the possibilities of, wait, I can do this. Like, maybe I'm not going to go be vice president, but now the rules are broken and I don't have to accept the barriers that are in front of me. And I think that's the opportunity in front of us is seeing role models like yourself, Vice President Kamala Harris, to say like, we can do something greater than what we think we can do.
Right. The new vice president has, I know, already affected so many people and will continue to do so in the years to come. In that way where kids, it just stretches the idea of what they think they might be able to accomplish and gives them ideas they might never have thought of otherwise. And so it's just really amazing to see that now.
Oh, yeah. I'm so excited. I mean, you, speaking of leadership, you became the second female director to run the Johnson Space Center. First of all, that's some Wonder Woman power right there. But what did that role entail? Because I imagine you're managing teams, you're setting goals. Like, take us on a journey of what it was like for you to be a director.
Yes. Well, it was a huge privilege to be the director of Johnson Space Center. It's really the home of human spaceflight for our country. And so much has been accomplished by the team there, of course, long before I got there, but also since as well. So we have about a little under 3,000 government employees that work there, and then about another 7,000 or so contractor employees who either work on site or in most cases right around there in the local community. And so we are responsible for the operational human spaceflight programs, as well as the development programs and looking well into the future. And so we have an engineering group, probably the largest group that we have there. Of course, we have the astronauts, we have the people that work in mission control and all the folks that work in the back rooms that you don't necessarily even see. We have a human health and performance group who is really trying to make sure that astronauts stay healthy in space and can perform at a high level, as well as trying to understand and mitigate any long-term health effects that there might be. And then, of course, we have folks that also curate all the materials that come back from space, like the moon rocks and other materials that have subsequently come back. And we have a number of scientists who study that kind of thing. And then, you know, all of the other people that make it happen, right? People who work in human resources, in our chief financial office, procurement, lawyers, you know, anything that it takes to make an organization of that size, and particularly one that's part of a federal agency, operate. So it's just an amazing group of people. And right now, of course, the operational program is the International Space Station. So Mission Control is really the coordinating center for all of that. And we have a number of people that support that, both on the engineering and operations side. Johnson Space Center is also developing a spacecraft to go beyond low Earth orbit called Orion. And they work with Lockheed Martin, who's the prime contractor on that. Of course, Johnson Space Center has worked with Kennedy Space Center on the Commercial Crew Program with the contracts that they have with both SpaceX and Boeing. And as you've seen, SpaceX has successfully taken NASA astronauts to and from now the International Space Station, and Boeing is working on demonstrating that for this year. So there's a lot going on, and it's a great workforce, you know, very talented, very passionate about what they do.
So they're really like the hub of future space exploration. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Being on the forefront of that. That's really exciting. We had one of our listeners ask the funniest question. Her name is Kelly Ray. I said, I will ask you. She wanted to know, like, what does space smell like? Because she says, supposedly there's a smell on the spacewalk.
Yes, there actually is a smell. And I think it's from the atomic oxygen. And when you notice it is, let's say a couple people have gone outside to do a spacewalk, and now they come back in, you've pressurized the crew lock, and then you open the hatch so that they can come back into the pressurized part of the shuttle or the International Space Station. And there is a smell associated with that as you open that hatch. And different people describe it different ways, but it's a little bit of a barbecue, a little bit of a barbecue smell, but that's metallic in a certain way. So you can almost feel it on your tongue if you kind of know what I mean. By a little bit of a metallic twinge to
it.
But yes, I have noticed that. And certainly a lot of astronauts have noticed that. You know, obviously, most of the time you're just inside your spacecraft. And so we bring up our own air and we condition it, and you wouldn't smell it in that way. But when you are bringing people back in who have been outside doing a spacewalk, that's when you notice it.
That is so interesting, because when I read that, I was just like, this is ridiculous. But but I'm really fascinated that there's an actual real answer to that. So with that, we're going to take a quick break for today's Pioneering Women in STEAM segment, and we will be back with Dr. Ellen Ochoa.
And now it's time for today's Pioneering Women segment. Today's Pioneering Woman is Nikki Giovanni. Giovanni, born in Knoxville, is an American poet and writer who initially captured the public's attention with her work in the Black Arts Movement in the late 1960s. Her work ranged from calls for Black power, children's poems, and intimate personal statements. In 1967, Giovanni received her bachelor's degree and was deeply devoted to her presence in the civil rights movement. The release of Those Who Ride the Night Winds in 1983 was dedicated to highlighting Black American heroes and heroines. Her experience as a single Black mother helped inspire her children's poems. Her latest poetry collection, I Am Loved, released in 2018, paints a portrait of the many ways love shines in our lives. Thank you for your pioneering contributions, Nikki Giovanni.
Hello, innovators. We are back with Dr. Ellen Ochoa. We've been hanging out in deep space, smelling barbecue, avoiding asteroids, and becoming an astronaut while making history. So it's time to switch the tune, because we want to learn a little bit more about you, Ellen. A little birdie told me you are a classical flautist and played with the Stanford Symphony Orchestra, and you once received the Student Soloist Award. Now, help me out here. Like, you're into physics and math and science, but you're also into classical music?
Well, actually, I got into music long before I got into science. As I mentioned, you know, I was 2 or 3 years into college before I really got into science. But I started playing the flute when I was 10. So I played through junior high and high school. I was in the concert band, the marching band, orchestra, Civic Youth Orchestra of San Diego. And even when I went off to graduate school, I had the experience of being able to play at least some of the times with the Stanford Symphony Orchestra. And I did solo with the Stanford Chamber Orchestra. This is something that you have to audition for. So it was just a big part of my life. And I took lessons at Stanford the whole time I was there as well. I continued on from what I used to do in high school and college, and gave some solo recitals even after I graduated from graduate school. And I was lucky enough to actually be able to take my flute into space on one of my missions, my very first mission. One of our sort of our side jobs or other objectives was to film a video for kindergartners, first graders, second graders about living and working in space. So we ended up putting in a shot of me playing flute in space to just point out that you can continue on with some of your hobbies when you're in space, maybe a little bit about what's different and what's the same. So to me, it was just a wonderful way to be able to take this experience of music, which was really important to me, and kind of marry that up with my human spaceflight experience.
I think that is so incredible. Is that something that our listeners can Google? Is there like photos floating around on Google?
There's definitely a photo. And I think there's a very short clip of me playing, although I never think it sounds particularly good, but not quite the way I remember it exactly. But yeah, there's a little bit of that out there.
We are always our worst critics, I'm telling you. Always. Do you still play?
Just for myself.
Yeah.
You know, for a long time, it was just really hard other than getting in, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of practice in the morning with my job and my kids and all. But when I retired from NASA 2.5 years ago and moved to Boise, Idaho, I hunted up the instructor here at Boise State University. So I periodically take lessons and sometimes play duets. One of the things I like about music is you can really do it your whole life just as a hobby.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I sing, but I would never like go perform somewhere, but I do it for myself. So I get it. Like there's days I'm just like in a Ella Fitzgerald mood and a Cole Porter, you know, I listen to a lot of Cole Porter.
Oh, wonderful.
Music. Yeah. And so I grew up on that. I also was in choir, madrigal choir, a cappella choir, show choir, but I'm not as great as I was when I was super conditioned in training, but I can still hold my own at a karaoke bar or in my bathroom where the acoustics are the best, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So we can also add TV star to your extensive resume, because there's an episode of True Colors streaming on Peacock TV all about you.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that kind of came up out of the blue. They were looking at doing episodes of 8 different people of Hispanic heritage in the United States from different kinds of fields and profiling each of them about 20 minutes each or so. So this show is called True Colors, and one of the episodes is about me. Now, of course, the tricky part was this was during the pandemic. So first of all, the camera crew that came, you know, they were getting COVID tested before they left LA, after they got to Boise. They didn't spend too much time in our house, but what time they were, everybody, of course, was masked up. And then we tried to do a lot of the filming outside in order to do it safely as they were trying to do this during the pandemic. But I was really glad that they included somebody from the STEM fields, because a lot of times that is sometimes overlooked as I look at people from, you know, sports and entertainment and business and things like that. So I was glad to get that flavor out there. So again, people who are watching realize, hey, this is an interesting and challenging field, and we need more people entering that field, particularly people who are underrepresented. There is a little bit of my flute in there too.
Oh, is there?
My instructor and I were playing duets out on our back patio, and they put a little bit of that in the background.
Oh, okay. So now I really need to check this out, because I'm so excited to just hear all the beautiful facets of you. I love that I get to be privy to that as well as share that with our audiences, because, you know, we do need very real role models. I mean, this is what I actually created this podcast with my team, because we wanted to get behind the scenes of the people that we see on our stages and out in the world, you know, doing these remarkable things, being scientists, being engineers, being entrepreneurs. A lot of times we don't get to see, you know, pull back the curtain and see who they are as humans and learn about like their backstory, learn about their fears, their successes, their wins, and their vulnerabilities. And this show is all about truth and vulnerability. So Ellen, I'd love you to share something that you've never shared with anyone else before.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, as I'm sitting here at my desk, I'm staring at the screensaver on my computer, which happens to be a picture of the South Pole Station. And so I'm on the National Science Board, and the National Science Foundation is the one that runs the U.S. Antarctic Program. And they have three stations, essentially, in Antarctica. The big one that most people have heard of, McMurdo, and then there's one called Palmer Station. And then they actually have the only station at the South Pole. And I got a chance to visit as a National Science Board member a couple of years ago. And to me, the parallels between, you know, sort of living and working and trying to supply people at the South Pole were very similar to me to what it takes to, you know, get people to space and keep them in space and keep them supplied, you know, with food and water and everything else. So in addition to it just being a great adventure to go there, I just really love talking to the people, the scientists, but also the operations and logistics folks, because it was just so familiar to me based on what we do at NASA with the International Space Station Program. And it's interesting because when they take visitors like me there, rather than, let's say, a scientist who's going to spend maybe several weeks there, generally, you only get a visit of 2 hours long. And what they do is they'll have a couple of planes leave McMurdo, fly to the South Pole, which is about a 3-hour flight from the McMurdo station in Antarctica. And they don't want to shut down the aircraft if they don't have to, because it's so cold there and they're concerned about not starting up again properly. You know, seals can leak and that kind of thing. So they send two aircraft about an hour apart. And of course, there's always supplies on the aircraft and other people who are going to be staying for a long period of time. So they offload everything. They give us a tour. And then the first aircraft flies back after being on the ground for about an hour. The next aircraft arrives. And then visitors like me, who are there for, you know, a specific purpose, oversight, are taken back on the second plane. So you get about 2 hours and you have a chance to walk around at least part of the station, meet some of the scientists, hear about what they're doing, and, you know, just get a view of what it's really like and really see the geographic South Pole of the Earth, which is pretty exciting. Well, the day that we were there, the weather back at McMurdo actually turned bad. And so they had the second aircraft turn around before it ever got to the South Pole. Then they decided the first aircraft, the one that we came in, was not going to be able to fly back that day too. So they actually did have to shut it down. And we actually ended up being there about almost 24 hours. So we had much more time to wander around the station. We got to go out and visit the South Pole Telescope. There are several smaller science facilities that are, say, 200 yards away from the main station. So we got to see those, the Ice Cube Neutrino Experiment. You know, eat in the cafeteria there. We actually got to go 55 feet underground where the water and sewage lines run. And it stays at a constant minus 55 degrees Fahrenheit down there.
Oh, my God. No.
So we kind of walked along those tunnels. And I just felt so lucky that, you know, we had a much richer experience there than we originally anticipated. And just really enjoyed getting to meet some of the folks who were working there, either as scientists or again as some of the medical staff and the chefs and the food service people. Wow. You know, everything that it takes to keep people alive down there.
Oh my gosh, that is such a fascinating story. And the whole time I was just thinking about how cold it must have been.
Well, you know, they give us all the gear that we need to use. So that's good. Oh, and the other thing, because we had extra time, we did get to, you know, see almost every room, you know, in the station, that at least that's a public room. And they had a music room, and there was actually a flute in there. So I put the flute together and started to play. And I thought, well, I know I'm not the only person to play flute in space. I was the first one, but not the only one. But I'm pretty sure I'm the only one that's played both in space and at the South Pole.
At the South Pole. Oh my God, that is so fascinating. It's once in a lifetime experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it. Well, that was such a fantastic story, Ellen. Thank you so much for sharing with us. I mean, you really have had such an incredible life. And you're still kicking. I mean, there's so many things for you to do. I'm like thinking, okay, what's next?
Yeah, I've just been so fortunate to have these amazing experiences in space and being able to visit Antarctica. But, you know, what I really think about when I think about my years at NASA is the people I worked with, right? I mean, it's really a team of people that make everything happen. They have to be dedicated and just really focused on achieving a goal. And, you know, being a part of that team, that to me was the best thing ever.
Oh, and I imagine, you know, your teams become family. You know, you have an
absolutely
have the biggest extended family. The who's who of people in your family, for sure. You've earned all of the incredible accolades. You have schools named after you, and you've certainly earned your rest. So looking back, would you take the easy road or the road less traveled, and why?
Well, you know, I had no idea what road I was really on, right? I mean, as I sort of just went year to year when I was younger, you know, I made certain decisions, but without really knowing exactly where I was headed. I know sometimes when people look at my resume, it looks like I knew exactly what I wanted to do and just went after it, but it certainly didn't feel that way at the time. But you know what? I did work hard. I took my education seriously and I worked hard at everything I did. And, you know, I think this is my parents' influence, especially my mom's, that good things will come when you work hard. You know, nothing's ever guaranteed, but it's going to put you in a better place than you would have been, you know, if you really weren't giving it your all. And looking back, I wouldn't change a thing.
Aww. And I'm glad that you didn't change a thing, because then we wouldn't be so inspired and fascinated by your journey. And because you have broken barriers and pushed forward, I mean, you really have created pathways for not just women and Latinas, but people who have felt marginalized and who have felt like, I can't do something because the world reflects to me that I can. And so, you know, I want to celebrate that. And you certainly have paved the way forward for future generations.
Well, thank you. You know, one of the reasons I like talking to you and doing other kinds of podcasts and speaking is just to let people know, you know, there's so many wonderful possibilities out there. A lot of times it seems impossible to reach certain goals. But, you know, I always felt like even if I'd never been selected as an astronaut, the fact that I was interested in it, it actually led to a position at NASA even before being selected as an astronaut. And I just would have had more opportunities no matter what, just because of the fact that I was interested in going after that position.
And then you went after it. That's the lesson that we all need to take with us, is once you have fostered that interest, go after it. Make your mark. Like, you never know where you're going to end up, whether you're going to be among the stars with Ellen or in the White House, like Vice President Kamala Harris. The sky is the limit. Thank you so much, Dr. Ellen, for being here with us. And we look forward to having you again in our ecosystem.
Thank you so much for being here, innovators. We'll see you next week when we take on the world one more time.